The first question I always ask, because people ask me all the time, is Donald Trump a representative of a fascist takeover? Is he a neo-Nazi? Is he someone who is going to qualitatively change the American political system away from a democratic system to a sort of empire, sort of like the Roman Empire? Is this the end of American democracy as we know it? You know Donald Trump. What do you think? Is that what he has in mind?
Well, you know, I'm not sure he has anything in mind, and that's the troubling aspect of all this. He's very impulsive. I liken him to a shark that moves through the water and consumes, and he's consuming attention. He's always looking to increase his power, but it's rarely been oriented toward a specific goal. He's never had an ideology other than Trumpism, and I guess if there's a danger in it, it is that. It's that he doesn't have an ideology that helps us to understand him. It's more about him and the personal expression of power. We've been watching in these first 6 months. It appears that there are institutions that are pushing back against him. And right now, at this moment, where his eldest son, Donald Jr., is really in very hot water, I think we're seeing the limits of his coping mechanisms. So things that he usually tries to get himself out of a jam don't seem to be working.
You know Donald Trump in the sense of you interviewed him a number of times for your book, The Truth About Trump. I was wondering if you could run down what it was like to actually be in the room and have a conversation with Donald Trump. I mean, is it possible to have a conversation with him?
Well, it really isn't a conversation. He uses interviewers as spurs for his monologues. So he, I think, rarely gets a question that he hasn't heard before, and he often has a prepackaged response. And this is something that I picked up on after I spoke to his children and his wives, all three of his wives. I discovered that they all know the stories, too, and they're not necessarily fact-based, because when you go look at the facts of what he claims, it almost always falls apart, but they all know the stories, and these are like legends or aspects of a myth that he promotes, and where did they get in trouble? And I think I noticed that people in the Trump orbit get nervous is when you ask a question that doesn't have a story to go with it. And then they have to scramble to somehow fill in the empty spaces. And that's why he'll say, well, I don't like to dwell on the past. I don't like thinking about who I was in the past. I'm always looking forward. So, no, it's not a conversation. It's a series of monologues, and I often thought that it was my job to see if I could ask that question that didn't have an immediate answer and see if I could get something spontaneous or genuine, but that was a really hard thing to do.
Was there any point you remember where you got something spontaneous or genuine from him that you can remember offhand?
Well, offhand, you know, I think of this issue that he should have had a really well prepared answer for, and it was his draft status during the Vietnam War. And he got 3 or maybe 4 deferments, a couple for being a college student, and then he had 1, maybe 2 for medical reasons. And I tried to be a little provocative. You know, I said that I saw his draft record, and there was a code next to the reason for his deferment, and I asked him if it was a psychiatric disability, and he bristled at that, and he said, no, it was bone spurs, and I, you know, just said, bone spurs, what are you talking about? And he said, well, I had these heel spurs, and he took off his shoes and tried to point out these bumps. I couldn't see anything that somehow indicated that he was unfit for the infantry. But we only got to that final answer because I had to explain to him how I knew about the deferments, how I knew. He once claimed that it was too late in the conflict for him to be drafted, and so he escaped because of that, and that's not true. But it took a lot of work, and in that one moment of honesty, I actually kind of liked him. You know, and I said that to him. I said, you know, Donald, for the first time, I think I kind of like you, because he was honest. And he immediately covered up and retreated into that act that he does, where he's not genuine and he's not sincere.
Well, people, you know, some people have said it, and, you know, it's hard to pick fact from fiction, even from his opponents, because he generates as much hate as he does love among his supporters and among those who dislike him. And, you know, the word you hear a lot of times, usually in the forum of people who dislike him, is that he's potentially mentally ill or not mentally has a mental disability in the sense of being able to handle stress and be able to handle a job like president. Did you get ever feel that, you know, and you're not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, and they're not allowed to say technically what they think, but plenty of people seem to be saying they think that he is not really mentally prepared to take on this job?
Well, I don't think that he's temperamentally suited to the job, and that's something we can talk about. You see his lack of impulse control and the way that he talks and his difficulty staying focused on a topic. And you don't have to be a professional to recognize that there's some issue there with his temperament. And the other thing that we can say is that he doesn't have the experience. And by that, I don't just mean life experience in his career. I'm thinking more about intellectual experience. He's not a well-read person. He very proudly will talk about the last book he read being in college. And he's not curious about the world. He hates to travel, hates being away from home. I would say his interest in being abroad now to escape domestic political issues suggests that it's the first time in his life that he has enjoyed traveling, because it means that he can get away from the White House press corps for a little bit.
How do you think he takes to being living in Washington, D.C.? I mean, it's not probably a town, it's a small town compared to what he seems to like, and he doesn't seem to like to be away from Trump Tower that much.
No, I don't think he's happy. And this is something that I think has gotten worse and worse. If you saw him with Emmanuel Macron today,
yes,
he
I did.
Seemed exhausted and distracted. And I just think that this job is much different from what he anticipated. He likes the ceremonial aspects. You know, if he can review the troops and see some horses trot by, he's going to enjoy that. But the pressures and the many different issues that he has to cope with on a moment-by-moment basis, if he's engaged in being the president, I think this doesn't appeal to him at all.
Do you think the people around him, not his inner circle of his family, but the Republican Party and the machine that sort of gave in to him and allowed him to become president, do you think they're trying to use him? Do you think they knew what they were getting into? Or do you think that he actually represents, as some people have said on the show, sort of a revolution of sorts? Not the type of revolution maybe you and I might be wish mm-hmm. for, but a revolution of sorts. And
I think that they are still perplexed by the Trump phenomenon. Nothing about him is normal. So you don't see him, even in the way that he speaks at press conferences when he has them. He, even today, he talked on at length about his son's problems with the email trail, leading us to understand the meeting that he had with the Russian attorney at Trump Tower. He talked too much. But yet, when other members of his party observe this and imagine that he's running aground, they go home and they see that the most rabid members of the party, the voters who put him in office, are sticking by him. and they're more popular than most members of Congress. I mean, he's more popular with them than members of Congress are. So you have this trap that they're in. You know, do you turn away from the most powerful person in your party and the one who has the stickiest support and stand your ground and say, you know, this is just too much? Or do you tread water? And I think right now they're all treading water, trying to decide which way to turn, and it doesn't seem to be an obvious option.
Mm-hmm. You know, in your book, and I got to read part of it so far, about his family and how they came from Germany, the Drumpfs, and
right.
You know, his grandfather and his father, and sort of how they seem to manipulate the system to become very wealthy men, and how Donald really didn't, although he was his dad's son, they didn't see eye to eye in the sense that his dad sent him to a military school. How do you think his family's history and his upbringing affected Donald Trump and made him the person he is today?
Well, I think a lot of the drama that we're seeing today and that people in New York have seen with Donald Trump going back to the 70s is rooted in his family and in his upbringing. His dad was a pretty savvy political operator on his own, but it was all about exploiting the system for financial gain. So he would exploit loan programs for veterans at first, coming back from World War II, and then the Mitchell-Lama program that developed housing in New York City and New York State. In all these cases, he used a lot of tricky methods to maximize his profit. I'll give you a good example. When he was with the Mitchell-Lama program, the way that worked was developers would send the bills for their expenses in putting up housing for the middle class right to the state agency for review, and then the bill would be paid. So instead of buying a piece of heavy equipment like a bulldozer and using it for his project, Trump would buy a used one through a different corporate entity and then rent it to himself and pay off the original price of the purchase many times over by renting it to himself. And then he would submit the bill, and the state would approve it, and he got the cash. You know, and this is all outside the spirit of the program. It's something that outraged the assembly in New York, in Albany, and they held hearings on it. But he was right within the border of the law. And I think this idea of doing what you can get away with and assuming that it's okay to do something if you don't get caught and you don't go to jail, this was something that I think Donald inhaled as a kid. These were the stories that were told around the dinner table. And he was, I think, naturally inclined to be aggressive anyway. That's what landed him in military school. But you know, there's this combination of the lessons from his father and this temperament that had him be a very aggressive and self-serving person, and the result is what we're seeing now.
I see. What do you think? Because you mentioned in your book the famous correspondence dinner, the one that he did not attend this year, where President Obama and Seth Rogen, I think, really gave it to him. I mean, humiliated him in public in front of people. And do you think that humiliation is what made him decide to run for president and get revenge against these people?
Oh, I think it was a big part of the motivation. You know, the thing to keep in mind whenever you're contemplating Trump is that everything is personal. So at that correspondence dinner, I think you could see in the video of it that he was seething. And really the president and the comedians who poked fun at him, they went about 10 steps too far, I think. If President Obama wanted to preserve his legacy, he could have been smarter than to humiliate Donald Trump at length in front of a national television audience, because I'm sure in that moment, Trump decided, I'm going to spend whatever it takes so that I'm the guy that challenges the Democrat who will seek to replace Obama in 2016. Now, I don't think that Trump actually expected to win, and I don't think that his son was expecting his father to win when he agreed to that meeting with the Russian lawyer at Trump Tower. I think this was improvisational, that he was angry, he was motivated, he began the campaign, and certainly through the primaries, I think he was surprised with each victory. And now we have this president who's almost an accidental president.
What did he tap into? And, you know, when I think of Trump, I mean, he claims that he's he constantly is claiming that he treats every person equally. But when you go back to his history, first of all, his father was in trouble for keeping people of color outside of his housing projects. Then Trump put that ad in the New York Times accusing the Central Park Five of rape and calling for the death penalty when they turned out to be innocent years later. So he was partially responsible for them serving many years in prison for a crime they didn't commit. He is constantly pandering to David Duke and the most backwards and racist. And this is where people are beginning to fear that this guy is some sort of fascist, people who don't know him. Who is this guy? What is his position on race relations in America?
Well, I think he's profoundly ignorant of them. I mean, I think this is a hard call to make. I was pushed during the election and afterwards by people who kept saying, is he a racist? Is he a racist? Well, I'm not sure that we have to determine that he's a racist in his heart. We can see that he says racist things and has done things that are very racially insensitive. And I think it's because he's never wanted to examine the privilege that allowed him so much success, you know, the fact that he was born halfway between third base and home plate and thinks he hit a home run. You know, a lot of us who are white males have a hard time accepting that we didn't create all of our success and that we get an awful head start over just about everybody else. So there's this ignorance, I think, would be the best word for it when it comes to the racial dynamic in our country and the history and understanding how the world really works. It's the same where women are concerned. I think that he generally sees women as objects. It's a retro kind of vision of gender, and the idea of equality, I don't think occurs to him. Mm-hmm. If you want to see a really good illustration, watch when he's present in a room where there it's mixed men and women. You know, first of all, it's hard to find a setting where there are very many women in it now around Trump. But even some of the archival footage of him, the women are often just decorative objects. They rarely speak, and I think that's the way he likes it. It's his comfort level.
Let's jump to the and we have to come back. We're going to discuss this more and have more time together because we're thinking of here at WBAI of using your book, The Truth About Trump. And we're speaking with Michael D'Antonio, the author of this book and many others, Pulitzer Prize winning author, you know, as a premium and to talk more with you over the days and weeks to come about your book and what the findings you have about Mr. Trump that are in that book. In Russia, he went to bring his Miss Universe beauty pageant, and where he met many of the people, and he even said in a tweet or a letter at the time that he wanted to be Vladimir Putin's best friend. Did he mean that? And do you think that he has ties either with the Putin government and or maybe organized crime figures from Russia?
Well, the most accurate thing I can say is that he has done business with people who are very connected to organized crime in Russia and in the former Soviet Union. A lot of the sales at certain Trump properties were to oligarchs over the years. And there's much yet to be discovered, and I think this is what Robert Mueller, the special counsel who's looking into all things Russian and Trump, is going to focus on quite intently. You know, I know that he has hired some people who are forensic accountants, and there are records available about a lot of these transactions. So I have no doubt that there are threads that lead to Putin, even if you think of the people who set up the meeting for Donald Jr. and the lawyer who supposedly had secrets to share about Hillary Clinton gleaned by the Russian government. You know, those people were Trump associates in the Miss Universe pageant, and they are also very close to Vladimir Putin. So he didn't need to be Putin's best friend in order to be connected to him and manipulated by Putin and his apparatus. You know, this is a regime that is treacherous, and they're seeking to compromise people in the United States, and I think the Trump crowd would be relatively easy to compromise.
Mm-hmm. Michael D'Antonio, anything you'd like to finish up with the next minute or two?
Well, I would like to tell people who are despairing about Donald Trump to note that he's struggling, and that were he to actually pursue something in a organized way, I would be quite shocked. You know, the main danger that we face is that he lacks control and is perhaps overwhelmed by the current situation. But to my mind, that leaves an opening for other branches of government and other institutions like the free press to help us, and I think they will.
All right. Thank you very much. We're going to have you on again soon. Michael D'Antonio, thank you. Great having you on.
Thank you.
And we have a couple minutes left. I'm opening up the phones. Anybody out there have a comment? 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818. And we've been talking to Michael D'Antonio, his book, The Truth About Trump. We're going to be offering this, I believe, as a I say I believe because I haven't got all the paperwork filed yet on this, and I don't want to get everybody in a bunch before we get it done. But The Truth About Trump might very well be a premium, and we'll be hearing a lot more from Mr. D'Antonio, who obviously has a lot of information and a lot of knowledge. So is there anybody out there? We haven't had taken calls yet, and I want to sort of have a segment now. We're going to try and take a few minutes of calls maybe at the end of each show and allow people maybe even to interact with the guests. So if you'd like to join me, Paul DiRienzo, on the air, and our number on the air is 347-335-0818. Is there somebody who's taking taking offense at what we've been saying here on this show? Is there somebody on the line right now? I see a red line. Let's take it. All right, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Renee. I'm calling from the Fox Fascist News Network. I'm with Refuse Fascism, and we are out here indicting Fox News for their lies, and we are out here also to indict Trump and Pence for the kind of things that they're trying to push forward. So you're probably going to hear sirens, and I apologize for that because I'm outside.
So you're out.
Hello.
Hi, hello. Welcome to the air. I'm glad to have you on. We only have a couple of minutes. So tell us why. What are you doing now? Why are you in front of Fox News at this moment?
Okay, so we actually just had a speak out. We had Hawk with Black Lives Matter, Greater New York. He was out here. He spoke out against police brutality and mass incarceration and the role that Trump and Pence are playing in that, as well as Fox News. And so we're out here. We actually are delivering a living indictment to Fox News right now. We have these 5-foot by 3-foot panels just listing all the actual facts that they do not tell the American people about this administration and the different things that are being put forward by the Trump-Pence regime.
Give me one example of something that really gets you mad about what Trump and Pence are doing.
Well, for me, I think the attacks on the media, for me, is like the craziest part. I mean, that's a key characteristic of fascism, attacking the media, and they are doing it. They put out these videos. There was one video of Trump physically attacking CNN, which is unacceptable. And then there was another YouTube video, I think Trump's son put out, of fighter jets taking down CNN. This is absurd, and it's completely ridiculous. And I just can't believe that we have people in power that are doing that, attacking
right. And so
the media.
There's an upcoming yeah. event this Saturday, right?
Yeah. So July 15th, Saturday, 4 p.m., Refuse Fascism is hosting a protest. The theme is that the Trump-Pence regime must go. We are meeting in front of Trump Tower, so you should be there. We are marching down 48th and Broadway. We're going to have a stage, some speakers, and then we are going to continue to march to Union Square. And so we are calling on everybody, if you hate what is going on, if you hate the lies, if you hate the attacks on the media, if you hate everything that this administration is doing, all the lies, all the attacks, and you need to be out there Saturday, July 15th, 4 p.m. Trump Tower.
All right, great. Thank you very much for that. And do you have a contact information, anything you'd like to put out when people can get in touch with you? Website?
I would just say refusefascism.org. Go to that website. If you're not in New York, you can find a protest near you. We have protests in about 17 different cities. So just find a protest near you and be on the streets. And the reason why we're out in Fox News, not only are we indicting Fox News for all the lies and the twisted stories that they put out, but we're also trying to embody the kind of protesting that people need to do. People need to be in the streets day after day, night after night, until they see the kind of change that they want to see.
Thank you very
it's
much.
Not enough to come out.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us on Trump Watch with Paul DiRienzo. And you can get in touch with me on Twitter, P. DiRienzo, P-D-E-R-I-E-N-Z-O. I'm easy to search. You can find this show on iTunes. You can find it on SoundCloud and many other podcast sources. And we'll see you next week with some more Trump Watch.